Hey.
Hi.
It's Crime and Time.
On the rocks.
And in Creole.
In Creole, which I don't have a Creole accent, so I can't do it.
No, I definitely don't. So this recipe is thanks to James. He's from the UK, and apparently this is a drink they drink there from time to time.
Okay.
I've never heard of it, but James, thank you.
Well, the name is not the Creole. It's the Creole Scream.
The Creole Scream, yes.
So you're screaming.
The Creole Scream.
Which is probably a very distinct thing, and I would love to hear it because I love a Creole accent. I had to do traffic school once, and the guy had a Creole accent, and it was really fun.
Well, this is fun, too, because it has some light rum, dry vermouth, Angostura bitters, and grenadine, and then you garnish with olives.
Very, very cool.
So we're using the green martini glasses. It's red, obviously, because of the grenadine, and then you have the martini olives,
which I'm just gonna put right here on my little napkin.
So yeah,
yay. I remember when The Princess and the Frog came out. Was it when children were getting to the age where we could like go see movies, and we went and saw it. I think
so. We were like 12 ish
no, much younger than that, but yes, we went and saw it a couple times. And that was the one we bought, because we didn't, Rapunzel was the first one that we went to the theater and saw. But they loved Princess and the Frog so much. It was child number two's favorite princess. And both of them loved the Zydeco music scenes. So anytime the Zydeco music would come on, I would just have two little girls just dancing like crazy in my living room.
I remember them watching that over and over.
Uh-huh. I like Zydeco music too. Don't get me wrong.
I'm going to try this drink.
Okay. I will too. And then I'll put ice in it. These martini glasses are different than the other ones.
Weird. It's a little sweet for me.
It's cough syrupy.
Maybe the olive juice will make it better eventually.
I don't know. I'm putting ice in it. Maybe that will make it better. Because it's got a cough syrup vibe for me.
Yeah, it's I think too much grenadine for me.
Uh-huh. It's just sweet. And you want some ice?
Yeah, I'll take a little ice.
That's a lovely sound next to the mic. And now you're dropping ice on your iPad.
We're
previous
good.
Episode, there was drink on your iPad.
Yeah, dropping ice on my iPad is much more preferable than gross alcohol drink.
For sure. Which was a good alcohol drink, but this one is...
Yeah, I just meant the fact that it's on my iPad is
exactly
gross.
Exactly.
All right, well, I am going to go classic Creole killer.
Okay, I'm going to keep trying this drink.
And I'm going to tell you about Madame LaLaurie.
Ooh!
So, Delphine LaLaurie was born Marie Delphine McCarty on March 19th, 1787 in New Orleans.
She's older than my person. So, this is our second time in Crime and Time history.
Oh, I beat you on oldness.
Crime story is older than my history story. Love.
Yeah. She had four siblings. Both of her parents were prominent in the town's Creole community. Her uncle was the governor of the Spanish-American provinces of Louisiana and Florida during the late 1700s.
Oh, so she is a mucky-muck.
Yes. And her cousin was the mayor of New Orleans from 1815 until 1820.
Well, she's a girl. Her family is mucky-mucks.
Her family, yes.
She's got vagina disease that we talked about.
Unfortunately.
Season one.
In June of 1800, at the ripe age of 13.
Oh my God.
Delphine married her first husband, Don Ramon de Lopez y Anguelo.
Oh my God. How old was he? 34?
I don't have how old he was, but
34.
He must have been 34, because he was a high ranking Spanish royal officer.
13.
Yeah.
Is gross.
13. 13.
I mean, I know people married younger those days, but that's still gross. Did she have boobies?
I didn't see a picture of her, so...
I can't imagine she did.
Anyway, she must have had something, because...
She had a baby 10 months later?
Very soon thereafter gets pregnant.
Stunned.
So they decide to go back to Madrid. Delphine was pregnant, and... her husband suddenly died aboard the ship. So she gives...
Not a tragedy.
Probably
Sorry.
Not.
That's a horrible thing to say. Yes, it's a tragedy. She's now a 13-year-old pregnant widow. Oh my God.
With a newborn.
That sentence. He doesn't like it either.
So she gives birth to their daughter, and she's named Marie Borja Delphine López y Angulo de la Candelaria.
Say that time five times fast.
They gave her the nickname Borquita.
Okay.
I don't know if Borquita is that pretty, though.
For some reason, I thought you were going to say Borgia. Probably the 13-year-old bride part.
Well, Borgia was, like, part of the girl's first name. Borgia. Mm-hmm. And so they called her Borquita.
That's Spanish.
Yeah.
Very.
So they go back to New Orleans, Delphine does, with her new baby. And then in 1808, Delphine marries her second husband, Jean Blanc, who was a French banker, a lawyer, a merchant, and a legislator.
How old is she now?
In 1808, she must have been 22.
Okay. She probably had a little more say in husband number two, because she'd already done the duty for daddy of making the political connections.
Yep. So this time they had four more children. And then in 1816, Blanc died, and I don't know why, but he died.
She killed him.
Perhaps.
I was kidding.
On June 25th, 1825, so she takes a break from marrying people.
Oh, good.
She marries her third and final husband, Leonard Louis Nicholas Lalaurie. He was a lot younger than her, and he was a physician.
Good for her.
Mm-hmm. And then in
I know I'm not going to like her later. So
no, she's not a good person.
She's not a good person. I mean, she had a rough... I mean, 13 years old is too young to be married.
Still, though, she's not a good person.
Right.
There's no excuse.
I know. I mean, I know the story. I know.
In 1831, she is able to purchase some property in her own name. She did have her husband's help in securing the paperwork and everything in order to do so, because he was an attorney.
One thing that I did find interesting in Creole culture, women had a lot more rights than they did in typical French, Spanish, or American culture.
Oh, interesting.
I don't really talk about it, but I talk about where I learned that from.
Yeah, so she was able to buy her own property, even though she was currently married when she did this.
Right, which is not something that the majority of women in those three countries were able to do. Because if you are married, all of your property belongs to your husband.
Absolutely.
So, even if you came into the marriage with it, you sign the marriage license, it's now his.
It's, yeah, absolutely. That's part of your dowry, basically.
Yeah. Which is horrible and gross.
This is getting a little better now that it's got some olive juice in it.
Tolerating it.
So in 1832, she had a two-story mansion built on the property and included an attached slave quarters.
Attached?
Yes.
Interesting.
In November of 1832, Delphine petitioned the court for separation from her husband because she claimed that Lalaurie had treated her in such a manner as to render their living together unsupportable.
She reminds me of that Duchess. Of course, I can't think of her name right now.
I'm not going to think of it because I have the worst memory for names.
The Duchess who killed all the people, she bathed in the maid's blood and... They, like, didn't send her to prison. They just bricked her up in a room and said, you live here now.
Okay.
Yeah. She was Transylvanian or one of those countries. But this story reminds me of that story.
Yeah, I have the worst memory.
Yeah. Because husband was not a good dude. She went off the deep end and killed people.
Yeah, I don't even know that her husband wasn't a whore. Like, it's not like... There's no evidence that he was horrible to her. But...
She just claimed that in court?
Yeah.
But that's pretty... In those days, to file for divorce or separation is ballsy.
Yeah. But she was a ballsy woman.
She was a ballsy woman.
So, during that time, it was customary for society women to have slaves.
And, in the South, yeah.
Yes.
It's surprising, though, that her slave quarters were attached.
Yeah.
Most were not.
Well, so... New Orleans was a little bit different.
It was, yes.
So, most people in town were kind of shocked at how polite and nice she was to them. She was very kind to them in public.
Her slaves or people in the city?
The slaves.
Okay.
So, in 1819 and 1832, she even released some slaves.
Which was not easy to do because most states, which is what one of the reasons that Thomas Jefferson wasn't able to manumit his slaves, because most states had a law that you had to provide enough security in a bank account to cover their living for their entire lives in order to free them.
So the article that I looked at for this actually said that she manumitted her slaves, but I...
That's the word for it.
I looked it up because I was like, I'm going to say that, and then you're going to be like... what is that? And I'm going to be like, I don't know
what that is.
You absolutely do. So soon, though, there began to be rumors that her politeness was just a public act.
Yeah.
But in New Orleans, unlike a lot of other southern cities and states, there were laws to protect slaves from cruel and unusual punishment.
Is that the Noir laws?
It could be.
I talk about those.
Oh, good. You'll get more later.
You'll get more later.
It turns out, though, that the conditions at the Lowry Mansion were far from adequate, even for this time, date and time.
I'm stunned.
Yeah. There were rumors that she was keeping secret slaves for her physician husband to practice Haitian voodoo on.
Oh.
Unsubstantiated, though. Like, there's nothing I could find that expanded on that. There were other reports that her cruelty extended to her daughters, who she would punish and whip if they tried to help the slaves in any way.
That's sad.
Yeah. One of the recorded and verified stories is that one man was so scared of punishment that he threw himself out of a third-story window.
Well, from what I have heard from different podcasts and American Horror Story and just limited research that I've done, he probably was smart to do that.
Yeah, he basically chose death rather than being subjected to her torture. So the window was then cemented shut. It's still visible in the Lowry Mansion today. The other verified report is about a 12-year-old slave girl named Leah. So Leah was brushing... I almost forgot about this. I was thinking about this all night. So I didn't take French in high school.
Right.
But I did have some friends that took French. And the French teacher at our high school, she would get really, really, like, angry if you said madame. Because it's
madame.
Madame or madame. And, of course, I always say madame. But she would say, madame, foot stuck in the door. If you said
funny.
That.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, anyway, madame Lowry, was she was brushing Madame Lowry's hair. And she pulled a little too hard, and Lowry flew into a rage and started to whip her. And then Leah climbed out onto the roof and leapt to her death. And then later, witnesses saw Madame Lowry burying the girl's body.
Wasn't there something about a baby in there, though, with that same story?
I didn't see a baby referenced.
Okay.
Anyway, police did fine her $300, and they made her sell 9 of her slaves after this incident. But
did she get to keep the money? So she, I mean, yes, you have to sell 9 pieces of quote-unquote property that you probably need, but they're not taking away the money for it.
No, and they did also didn't, they like basically turned their backs when she purchased them all back.
Oh, that's disgusting. Yeah. And $300 is not that much money to someone like that.
No.
And then she just turned around and bought them all back and then did horrible, gross things to them.
Horrible. So in 1834, a fire broke out at the Lowry Mansion. It began in the kitchen.
Okay, now I've heard that that was purposely set by the slaves because they'd prefer that than what they were given.
That was like literally my next
sentence. Oh, sorry.
So when the responders arrived, they found the cook, a 70-year-old woman, chained to the stove. And the cook told the fire marshal that she had set the fire on purpose in order to commit suicide because Delphine had kept her chained up all day and she was punished for the slightest infraction. And that's basically when the truth came out about Madame Lowry.
Right.
So while they were trying to put out the fire, there was a bunch of bystanders that came to help. They broke down the doors of the slave quarters and they found 7 more enslaved people that were chained to walls.
Chained to the wall.
And not only were they chained to walls, they had been mutilated and tortured.
Ugh.
And they all survived, and they later told the police that they had been kept there for months like that.
Oh my goodness. Now, okay, I'm going to stop talking. You talk.
There was an article the day after the fire in the New Orleans Bee, and it says, upon entering one of the apartments, the most appalling spectacle met their eyes. 7 slaves, more or less horribly mutilated, were seen suspended by the neck with their limbs apparently stretched and torn from one extremity to the other. These slaves were the property of the demon in the shape of a woman.
Yeah.
They had been confined by her for several months in the situation from which they had thus providentially been rescued, and had been merely kept in existence to prolong their suffering and to make them taste all that the most refined cruelty could inflict.
Wow.
First of all, props to whoever wrote that. That's some really excellent
great
writing.
Prose.
Yeah. But that just,
Well, I've heard things about mouths being sewn shut, filled with things you don't want in your mouth.
Mm-hmm. And it got real dark.
Yeah.
Real dark. It
like a beauty treatment that was made with baby livers or something like that.
And then this account says that they were flayed open and wore spiked collars so that they could not move.
Ooh.
It's just like the darkest of the dark. Like, that is truly evil.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So after the fire, they questioned I called him doctor because he is a doctor, but he's the Mr.
Yeah.
Lowry. And he told investigators, mind your own business.
So he was complicit.
I think so, or he was just so whipped also. I don't know.
But she did divorce him.
Yes, but he was still at the house frequently.
Weird.
So he knew what was going on.
Oh, for sure.
So during the fire, Madame Lowry escaped. And after all the abused people were discovered, this angry mob went to the mansion and destroyed it.
Good.
So, following the fire, two of the slaves that had been rescued ended up dying. In addition to that, investigators excavated the backyard. They found more bodies. One of them was Leah, the child that had jumped from the roof. And then there's all these varying reports on how many others were found. But wow. There were multiple others.
Yeah.
So, not much is known about what happened to Delphine after the fire. But there are some reports that she fled to France. There's records in France that indicate she died in Paris in 1849. However, there's a plate on a tomb in the St. Louis Cemetery in New Orleans that reads, Madame Lalaurie, née Marie Delphine McCarthy, décédée à Paris le 7, I don't know how to say that in French, December 1842.
Huh.
So that's, you know, what is that, 7 years earlier. But she gone.
She gone. Good. Well, okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
I was going to say, the character in the American Horror Story, the whole thing was someone put a curse on her because she was a character in American Horror Story. Same season as there was a character for My Person. But there was a curse put on her so that she was alive in the grave.
Oh, creepy.
To get back at her. The deceased people through voodoo put a curse on her so she would stay alive.
And I've not seen that, so.
It's a good season.
I may try to look that season
up. I've only seen two of them, and that was one of them. I watched that one and then the clown one from the 60s.
Well, and I do know that they did use the actual mansion as the facade.
The set? Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, except for that. Since I already mentioned this, the original mansion didn't survive because the mob destroyed it. But it sat ruined for about 4 years, and then a man, Pierre Trestor, built it.
Why would you want to restore that?
I
would rip it all out and start over.
Well, he pretty much did.
Good.
There is some similarity, though. So.
Well, that building style was...
Yeah, common. Very common. So over the next so many decades, the house was used for a public high school, a conservatory of music, an apartment building, a house for delinquent youth. It was a bar. It was a furniture store, and then turned into a luxury apartment residence.
I don't think I'd want to get drunk in that building.
I would.
I don't know. It's creeping out.
I mean, I would at least go in and get my drink. Ugh. You could always walk away from it.
You could.
Unless
you were chained with your mouth sewn shut.
True. In April of 2007, Nicolas Cage bought the house for $3.45 million.
That does not shock me at all.
No. But it went into foreclosure. So in 2009, it was purchased by a financial corporation for $2.3 million. And today, the mansion that's on 1140 Royal Street in New Orleans has a reputation for being the most haunted place in New Orleans, but... That says a lot, because New Orleans has a lot of haunted places.
New Orleans has a lot of haunted places.
People that have been there claim that they hear blood-curdling screams and eerie figures and restless that are coming from the restless slaves that emanate from the mansion.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, as usual, I used Wikipedia, I used allthat'sinteresting.com, the Crime Museum, History Mysteries, and Thought Co.
Interesting. So, we went on the haunted tour of Sacramento.
Yes, we did.
Old Sac. I want to do New Orleans, and I want to do Deadwood. When I was in Deadwood, I didn't realize that they had one.
Oh, exciting.
And so we need to go and do that.
Well, so next month...
add that to our travel list.
Next month, on Friday the 13th, I have tickets to Zach Bagans' Haunted Museum in Las Vegas, Nevada.
So jealous.
On Friday the 13th.
I'm so jealous.
I'm so excited. They're expensive, but...
funny.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, remind me. I got to ask you about our concert.
Oh, yeah.
So my, where I found out where the women, I did not use this for my article, but I, or my piece, but I used this to think of a person to do because I was going to do Madame Lillery. Because I thought you would do the soldier, the ex-soldier who killed his girlfriend in the middle of Katrina. I just was positive you were going to do that.
No.
I don't remember his name. I've read the book about it. It's a fascinating
case. I don't even know about it.
He did some horrible things.
Every time I looked up like Creole and like murder, killing, whatever on my search, It was like all Lillery.
Which surprised me because this case was massive. Like he... well,
maybe Creole didn't hit with that.
It could be. Yeah, I don't know. He obviously had PTSD and went a little nutso, and he and his girlfriend like had this big... they stayed in New Orleans during the hurricane and would just give food to people, welcome people in if they didn't have any place to go. And then one day he went nuts and chopped her into pieces and cooked her to preserve her. And yeah, it was bad.
I don't know that cooking equals preserving.
No way. Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't preserve a lime by cooking it.
No. That's what he thought he would do. Well, he was trying to reduce the smell, I guess. I don't know. He ended up jumping off the roof of a parking structure to kill himself.
Good for him.
Yes. But anyway, so like I said, where I found my person and that information about Creole culture and Louisiana State giving women more rights was found in, I'm very impressed with this source, 2005 La Madame et La Mademoiselle Creole Women in Louisiana, 1718 to 1865, which was a master's thesis written by one Katie Frances Morales for Louisiana State University Agriculture and Mechanical College.
Go so, Katie.
Katie, no one ever reads theses. I'm going to read your thesis because I was fascinated by it.
Also, side note, I'm starting to get why you put the olives with a sweet drink. It's kind of like a
balancing
palate cleanser.
Yeah. I still am liking the watered down version. It's super sweet. So I will give my sources now for my thing because I discovered, and I don't know why I didn't think of this, because of the song from our childhood. Do you have it now?
No.
Woo! Maria Lava.
Don't know it.
Don't know the song? Oh my gosh. It was a song from this, like the cowboy guys that had all those spooky songs. Anyway. Maria Laveau, New Orleans Voodoo Queen, History, Wikipedia, and Maria Laveau, Home. So I'm obviously doing Maria Laveau.
Maria Laveau.
So the song is so good. It's Don't Go Into the Bayou at Night, blah, blah, blah.
Ooh, sounds creepy.
It's really a cute song. It's a cute song. So she was a free person of color living in New Orleans. The New Orleans, an article in the New Orleans Times Picayune, which I just love that
Picayune
name. The New Orleans Times Picayune. I read it there. In April 1886, they remembered her as a, quote, gifted with beauty and intelligence who ruled her own race and made captive of many other. She proclaimed herself to be the Pope of Voodoo.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So she was a Creole woman who set her own rules in a time period where women and women of color often didn't have a lot of power. Maria had some power.
I feel like every time they depict a voodoo person on any like TV show or movie, it's always a black woman, and that's probably where this comes from.
Oh, for sure. She is the quintessential voodoo queen. In fact, in the same American Horror Story series that features Madame LaLaurie, they have a character played by Angela Bassett. Madame LaLaurie is played by Kathy Bates. And Angela Bassett plays Marie Laveau in that same series for American Horror Story.
Oh, wow. I'll have to maybe try to check that out. I don't know
what it's good. They also have the...
I don't have the Netflix, so I don't know what it's playing on, but...
Yeah. They also have a character that is the... which is another one we should do. The Axe Murderer of New Orleans. You don't know the Axe Murderer of New Orleans?
I think I vaguely remember hearing a story about it. Were they playing jazz every time they did that? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So anyhow, Marie Laveau was born... It is believed there is not a lot of concrete information on her. Most of the information that I got is based on baptismal records, because there's not a lot of concrete information on her or her children, because they are A, 1800s, early 1800s, but also B, they're freed people of color. So there's just not, you know, who cares? We're not going to write them down.
Yeah, they're not in the Catholic list of births.
So. They wrote down their baptism dates and the one marriage, and that was about it. But anyway, so anyway, she was believed to have been born in the French Quarter on or around 1801, which is gathered from, again, records and math. Her mother was Marguerite Darcantrelle. Lots of French names. I'm going to do my best.
So her and Madame LaLaurie were existing at the same time.
Sort of, yes. Yes.
Madame LaLaurie in 1800 was 13.
Okay, so yes, they were contemporaries. Completely different lifestyles, though.
Different lifestyle.
Yeah. So Marguerite, her mother, was a freed mistress of her father, who was Charles Laveau, who was... New Orleans was such a fascinating place because of the different different classes that Creole, which Creole culture is a mixture of... American Indian, white, French, Spanish, and African American people, as they all kind of mixed together in this melting pot of New Orleans, they developed their own culture. And so he was a wealthy mulatto businessman, and she was a free woman of African descent, Native American and French descent. Her mother was a former slave, and she was born in the house of her grandmother. Maria was born in her grandma's house. After mommy has her in grandma's house, mommy hands grandma the baby and says, "Going back to my man. Bye.
I'm out."
So she goes back to her wealthy businessman, Charles Laveau. So Maria was the first woman, or the first person in her family to be born free. Her grandmother was brought to New Orleans as a slave from West Africa in the mid 1700s. She was then purchased, and this is crazy, by a free woman of color.
It's not that crazy. There was hundreds.
A lot. Oh yes, Marie Laveau herself owned 7 slaves throughout her lifetime. Most people don't know that. That's why I say it's crazy.
People don't know that, but it's not crazy.
It's not crazy to historians, but to the average everyday citizen, I don't know that they realize that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so she's owned by this, grandma is owned by this free woman of color, and grandma actually eventually earns enough money to purchase herself. She must have had Marie's mommy by the time she purchased herself, but she purchased herself and probably her child, and then built a small home in the French Quarter. And that is where Maria was born and where she would live her life. But she was the first one that was born as a free woman. And then, like I mentioned, she owned 7 slaves during her lifetime, because she found herself... Well, she did all right for herself. And then she also had a very wealthy man. But on August 4th, 1819... it's estimated that she married a man named, here come the French names, Jacques Perry, and he was a free person of color from Haiti. And they got married at St. Louis Cathedral. Her father had never married her mother, but he signed the documents saying he was Marie's rightful father and he gave permission for her to be married.
Oh, wow.
Because I guess that's what you had to do at the time. Now, the wedding contract was signed on July 27th, 1819, and the wedding mass was performed by Father Antigo de Sadala. So there's Spanish names in here too. He was the priest known as Pierre Antoine. Jacques was part of a large group of white and Creole of color immigration of refugees to New Orleans in 1809 from the Haitian Revolution.
That's a whole nother story.
Oh my gosh, I want to talk about LaSalle so bad. We need to find a story that will work for that. So the documents show that in 1822, so her dad gave her a wedding present of a house.
Nice.
On Love Street, which is now called North Rampart. But by 1822, what is that called that you do all the time? Documents, but the one that happens, the census, showed them living in a house on Delphine Street.
Delphine Lalaurie.
I don't know. Between Dumatre and St. Philip. And they list Jacques as a cabinet maker. However, some sources say that Jacques and Marie never had any children, but there are baptismal records from St. Louis Cathedral that show entries for two daughters. One is Marie Angelie Perry, baptized in 1823, and Felicity Perry, baptized in 1824. They're both listed as daughters of Marie Laveau and Jacques Perry. However, the record for Felicity says that she was 7 years old at the time of her baptism, which would mean that she was married, or she was born in 1817, which was 2 years before Marie and Jacques' wedding. Which is not that massive of a deal at the time.
I can see that. I can see that being plausible.
But that's where the records end. Oh. There's no other mention of those two girls ever again.
Weird.
There's their baptism, and then that's it. And then, on top of that, there is never a mention again of Jacques.
What happened?
Don't know. He goes away. In Felicity's baptism, her father is listed as deceased. So he is listed in the marriage, and he is listed in one of the girls' baptismal records, and then he's gone.
In Felicity's baptism, she was already 7 years old, and her father's listed as deceased.
Yes.
Hmm. That almost seems like the Marie had a child that she wanted listed as his.
Maybe.
But maybe wasn't his.
But there's no death record for him. There's no death record for the children.
Huh.
There's no marriage record for the children. It just stops. Unless they change their name, which could be.
Well, if they were born in the 20s, technically they could still be... Oh, no, 1820s. Yes. Never mind.
And they could be... There was not... Aside from listing different names, a lot of times names were spelled so differently from one record to another because there was not necessarily a spelling. Just whomever is writing the record spells it however the frick they want.
Yes.
So it could have gotten so misconstrued
that it turned into a whole different name.
Correct. So we don't know. But anyway, we do know that she called herself the Widow Perry for the rest of her life. That was how she referred to herself.
That was her identity.
Yes, the Widow Perry. But anyway, we keep going. In 1826, she found love again with, oh my God.
French name.
Forgive me. Louis Christophe Dumesnil de Glapion.
Okay, that sounds pretty good.
I hope so. Anyway, Louis, good old Louis. He came from a very prominent New Orleans family, and he was a white man. So they were never allowed to be officially married.
Aww.
Because interracial marriage was illegal in New Orleans at the time.
Definitely.
Yes, but he stayed with her for the rest of his life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. In 1831, Grandma died, and a creditor came forward and said, "Your grandma mortgaged her house to me. It belongs to me now." And Marie tried to fight it, but she couldn't. The house was put up for auction, and Louis bought it.
Aww.
And they continued to raise their family there. they grew, they lived there for the rest of their lives. That was their family home until the end of the 19th century. He died in 1855. They had been together for almost 30 years. There is a discrepancy on children. There's no record of her ever taking up another love after he died in 1855. But she's also, what, 54 years old by this point?
Yeah, true.
And depending on which record you believe, she either has 15 or 7 children.
15 or 7? That's yes. A big difference.
Yes. So her and Glapon started having babies. Louis started having babies right away. One record says they had 15 children over the course of 20 years. Another record says that they had 7 during the time from 1827 to 1839. 3 of the children sadly died in infancy. Not uncommon, sadly. Yeah,
normal.
Marie Philippine Glapon was born a quote-unquote free quadroon in 1836, and she was the longest lived of the children. She is the one who most assume to be Marie II.
Okay.
Now, Marie II, there's a whole thing as to whether or not Marie II existed or whether or not Marie Laveau was just immortal and lived for a multitude of years. And the rumor is that the women cultivated this rumor.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So there's not really a lot known about Marie I. There is talk that she was a hairdresser, but there's also talk that it was Marie II that was the hairdresser, but she was a very sick, whomever it was very successful, and it was the wealthy white women that would come and have her do their hair. And as you do in the hairdresser's chair,
you
spill some secrets.
Yep.
And so that was where she would get her power and where she would also dole out, oh, you're having husband trouble. Well, I got a potion for you, honey. That type of thing. And in the American Horror Story, that is what Marie Laveau, who the whole thing takes place, I want to say the 90s, maybe? But the Marie Laveau character owns a salon.
Oh, so they're, yeah.
They're totally playing it, yeah.
Yeah.
So there was other things that she was said to do. She was a very generous woman of devout Catholic faith, and she would use her magic to help those in need. She attended mass often, and my iPad just did the skip thing.
Told you, you got to download the app.
I got to download the app. All right. Sorry, cut this out. Okay, she attended mass regularly, and her home was filled with images of saints, and she created a space that was protected and safe for all that lived and visited there. She was known to have attended prisoners. She was an advocate for prisoners. She would try to get paroles. There were rumors that when she would visit condemned prisoners, they might be slipped some sort of potion or poison that might lessen their suffering as they were hung or whatever their sentence was, but that was never proven.
Like an angel of mercy kind of thing.
Yes, but it was known that she would minister to prisoners and give them in the La Cabildo prison and would give them opportunities to repent and come to Jesus. Come to Jesus moment. Jack Kendall, who is a writer local to New Orleans in the 20th century, was not a Marie fan, but he was a self-expressed expert on Marie, which, you know, we're not. He said, quote unquote, after dark, you might see carriages roll up to Marie's door. Veiled ladies, elegantly attired, descended in a hurry to buy whatever the old witch had for sale. And ardent fraud, no doubt, but money poured into the lap down to her last day of her evil life. However, voodoo, which is what she was known to practice, is primarily a religion of protection. New Orleans voodoo is an Afro-Catholic religion and is one of the only Afro-Catholic religions to emerge and stay prominent in North Africa. So many of the slaves that came over brought with them elements of their home religion and culture and mix that with the Protestantism or the Catholicism that was taking place in the Americas or the South America or the Caribbeans, wherever they happen to land. But voodoo is the one that most people know. It was born of the influence of not only African nations, but the New World colonies, and became prominent. By the 1700s, there were many enslaved people in St. Dominique, Cuba, Brazil, as well as Louisiana. The Haitian Revolution began in 1791 and had a very significant influence on the creation of New Orleans voodoo. There are stories of the revolution that it started with a voodoo ceremony called Boy Cayman, where a voodoo priest led a service that included sacrificing a pig with an oath to overthrow the French. And then a few days later, rebel slaves began to burn the sugar plantations and kill the white population. The New Orleans Spanish Judicial Archives has a 1773 documented case in which several slaves tried to conspire to kill their master and the slave overseer by method of gri-gri. Now, gri-gri was in New Orleans, was a bag of herbs or magical substances that was carried with the intention to take control over another or for protection. It came from African gri-gri bags, which were blessed objects that were believed to carry magical protection or power and carried with you everywhere. I remember when I did the West African unit in my 7th grade history class, I thought that gri-gri were the storytellers. And that's what they called the storytellers. Huh. But apparently in other parts of the continent, they were this bag of sacred objects. But anyway, this influx of African and Haitian slaves coming into Louisiana after the rebellion began to blend their practices with the New Orleans free people of color and the slave population. And the elders passed down what they remembered to the younger people and passed these traditions on, and that became voodoo. The making and carrying of gri-gri bags was a part of voodoo practice. And I'm assuming I'm saying that right. I could be saying it wrong. I don't know. Tell me if I'm wrong. Would love to hear from you regardless. But anyway, it's very similar to the statues and the different things that the Catholics worshipped. And so it kind of blended seamlessly together. She, Marie, took her throne as the voodoo queen. There was a lot of speculation as to where she got her training. Some people have said that she received guidance under the Sante Dede and Maria Slapoe, who apparently one deposed the other. There was also speculation that she may have studied under the famous Dr. John. But most people believe that she probably learned Catholicism and voodoo from her grandmother and her mother because they were entrenched in this life of the African slave and in New Orleans and the free people of color in New Orleans and all of these.
That makes the most sense.
It does, because these people came from
Haiti.
They
had a blended lifestyle.
Yeah,
and it all blended.
It was one city where there were multiple cultures living and working together, and they all kind of formed, well, that is what Creole is
yeah.
Multiple cultures coming together, because Creole is not exclusive to New Orleans. There's Creole cultures all around the world. One of the things that I found was this island nation that considers themselves a Creole culture, but it had nothing to do with our Creole, so I wanted to do America's Creole, even though I kind of want to go on vacation on this island.
Any island sounds good.
That's right. Let's just go to an island. Anyway, so she was, it took her a very short time to dominate voodoo culture in New Orleans, and she became the queen of voodoo. During her decades as the queen, she was asked to solve questions of family disputes and health and finances. She performed her services in three main places. She would perform services in her home on St. Anne Street, at the Go Square, and at Lake Pontchartrain.
Pontchartrain.
Pontchartrain. Okay.
I don't know. I've heard that's like a big lake. Like it's There's like a hotel, like, I don't know. There's, I think there's a casino there. That's what I've heard of it.
Well, she was known to practice there. She was the third female leader of voodoo. Sorry, I need to take a drink of my cough medicine. The third female leader of voodoo in New Orleans. The first was Saint Santi Dede, and who ruled for years but was eventually usurped by Marie Salope, which are two of the people that she was rumored to have practiced under. Yeah, I was going to say,
those names sound familiar.
Yes. She maintained her authority, Marie, maintained her authority and through her leadership, and there was an attempt to challenge her in 1850, but it was not followed or carried through, and when she eventually died, New Orleans voodoo lost a large number of adherents. They, if I can't have Marie, I don't want anybody.
Oh, interesting, because you would think they would be like, who's next? Who can I go to?
No, they, if I can't have Marie, I don't want anybody.
That's because that means it was like about her, not about her. Yeah.
She was, well, it was about her or Marie too.
Yeah.
Don't know. So Congo Square, which was another place where she would work, you can go there and take a New Orleans cemetery ghost tour. And you're going to hear about Marie's followers and her mysterious gatherings. In the 1800s, there was a code called the Code Noir, which granted African-American slaves Sundays and holidays off. So during these Sundays and holidays, they would spend their time growing their own gardens, working themselves to earn their own money. They were allowed to do that in most places. Or they would go to Sunday worship at St. Augustine's Church. They would go over to Congo Square and set up goods. So that Congo Square was kind of like a marketplace, a gathering place. It was a religious place. Yeah. It was just on your day off on Sunday, you'd go to church and then you'd go sell your vegetables at the market.
At the square, yeah.
Yeah, and participate in this community building thing. So it sounded kind of fun and kind of neat. You know, farmers market-esque. So she would set up a little stand at the Congo Square on Sundays with her gree-gree bags and offer advice and services to the community. And this is kind of where she became the... She would often dance with her serpent. She had a pet snake.
Na, 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 na.
But she was very prominent as the queen of voodoo there. These celebrations happen weekly, but there was also one night a year where the Creoles practiced voodoo on St. John's Eve. St. John was St. John the Baptist, and this was typically done in observance of the summer solstice or Midsummer's Eve. It is acknowledged as a celebration among many cultures and religions, dating back to the Celtics and the Druids and the European pagan rituals. But for the New Orleans voodoo community, it meant coming together, ritual bathing, sacred waters, and communing around bonfires. And like the Sunday Congo meetings, St. John's Eves were led by Maria Laveau. We don't know a lot. Like, there's not a lot substantiated. There's a lot of rumor and conjecture, but not a lot of written documentation. Her snake was named Zombie. Apparently that was after an African god, and we don't really know if her magic was truly occult, if it was a mixture of the Roman Catholic and the African spirits and the Native American spiritualism. She kind of created her own little following that she bled into voodoo.
Makes me wonder, like, where the zombies came from.
I do too. I wonder what that whole thing is. Child number two is literally asking if she can have our orange right now.
Yeah.
The orange that we made from that drink.
Oh, it's for that one?
No, yeah, it's done.
It's all done.
Anyway, so...
It was, yeah.
It's gone. So by July of 1869, there was a local news column that said, June is the time devoted by the voodoo worshippers to the celebration of the most sacred and therefore revolting rites. So, not a lot of freedom of religion. They're being a little judgy. They describe them as midnight dances, bathing, eating together, and less than innocent pleasures.
I'm sorry, but has Catholicism looked at itself?
Right? This same article refers to Maria Laveau as the voodoo queen for a quarter of a century. St. John's Eve is still celebrated and revered. It takes place typically on Bayou Street and Bayou St. John in New Orleans, blah, blah, blah. Now, Maria II was, she was the more flamboyant of the two. She would wear a brightly colored turban. She had a lot of gold jewelry. She would walk around New Orleans like, this is my city.
I love it.
Yes. She said, she would often say, I am not white. I am not slave. I am not black, not French, not Negro, not African. I am a free woman, a Creole of New Orleans. That is how she identified.
Get it, girl.
Yes. So there was a whole thing with the switch, because Maria Laveau, the legend, lived longer than Maria Laveau, the person, should have lived. So her younger daughter looked very much like her. So it is speculated that as Maria Laveau, OG, aged, and Maria Laveau too aged, and they kind of crossed over, because, you know,
there was a point probably at which they could have been mistaken for each other.
So Laveau 2 started taking over more and more of the duties, and Laveau 1 kind of faded into oblivion.
Smart.
So now the legend is she's like 102 and look at her.
Yeah,
you know,
and she's like 41.
Yes. So it was the whole thing. She's not aging. What are, you know, she's powerful. Maria Laveau, OG, attended mass into her old age. She continued her daily routine, but she was just kind of seen as this, oh, there's a sweet little old black woman. You know, it was not,
she wasn't
the Maria Laveau, because her granddaughter was filling that role unbeknownst to all of these people, which is so super.
That's
cool.
Classic.
Yes, kind of love it. Maria too was speculated to be a little more wicked. She would do a little more black stuff, like black magic type thing. She was speculated to have been the hairdresser of whom all of the wealthy white women would come and see.
Okay, it makes sense.
Yes,
I can see that.
So while we don't know who exactly that she was, some people even think she was one of OG's granddaughters.
Oh.
Not even just a daughter, that she was a granddaughter. And then there's some people that say she was not even related to Maria Laveau at all. She just took up this mantle and started saying she was. Because honestly, how many people are going to remember exactly what someone looks like? If you just see a person far, far away leading a ceremony who has this general body shape and a turban, and then 6 months later or a year later you see another, are you going to really realize that those are not the same people?
Especially if the part about the hairdresser is the second person, then that makes sense. Because if the hairdresser with all these women coming to her every week
if that was
the first person, then they would have really known who she was.
They would have seen her up close more, yes. Yeah. And there's no photograph, so there's no photographic evidence at this point. So you're just seeing this woman who's saying she is who she is.
I could see that.
Yeah. Her tomb, on June 15th, 1881, it is said that Maria Laveau, I'm quoting, died peacefully in her cottage on St. Anne Street, a few months shy of her 80th birthday. Her tomb reads, "The Widow of Paris." She is buried in St. Louis Cemetery number 1. Now, her tomb is one of
Madame
the
LaLaurie
most...
is potentially buried there too.
Really?
In St. Louis.
Oh, that's interesting. Her tomb tops LaLaurie because it is the most visited tomb in all of New Orleans. And visitors have been less than respectful. There's a thing where if you draw an X 3 times, she has to grant your wish. So there's X's all over it. At one point, another group came in and it was a New Jersey... Oh, this is a different thing. So in 1982, a New Jersey-based punk rock group, The Misfits, were arrested.
The Misfits.
The Misfits.
I know who The Misfits are.
Really? Yeah. Well, they were arrested for trying to exhume her body.
They're super famous.
In 1982. The arrest took place in cemetery number 2, so there's all kinds of conflicting accounts. On December 17th, 2013, there was a vandalism of her grave, or what is believed to be her grave, by someone pouring latex paint.
That's
all
weird.
Over the grave. Yeah, pink latex paint. They had to remove the paint because it was latex and the tombstone is made of plaster. So if they don't remove it, the moisture is going to be trapped in the plaster and it'll disintegrate. There was a lot of criticism, however, because they used pressure wash to blast it off rather than paint stripper and wiping it off. So it did a lot of damage to the grave. At this point, you are not allowed to go to the grave unless you are with a licensed tour guide.
Huh.
So that you don't mark your three X's or pour pink paint all over it. The house was destroyed in 1907. So sadly, that is gone. But Maria Laveau is legendary. She is written about in books, in movies. She is the protagonist or the antagonist of multiple novels, multiple TV shows, movies, whatever. And like I said, this song, which I wish I had written down who it was that wrote this song, but she is a central figure to the history of New Orleans, and she was a healer and a philanthropist. She was a woman who nursed unfortunate souls who were stricken by yellow fever and ministered to prisoners in the parish prison. She attended mass daily, and she was also the voodoo queen for a quarter of a century. And we may never know all of these things because it's secretive. So I like Marie. I'm glad I found her.
Yeah, that was cool. I like that story.
Yeah, and I'm excited about reading Beth Ann. I don't remember her name. Her thesis.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and read that for sure.
She might be an expert.
She might be an expert. I'm not.
We're not.
I'm getting drunk for
just,
sure.
Just getting drunk.
Yay.
As always, you can contact us on Facebook at Crime and Time OTR.
On Instagram, we are Crime and Time OTR.
On Twitter, we're at Crime and Time OTR.
And our email is crimetimeotr@gmail.com. Email is where you will want to send us cocktail suggestions, things
topics,
you want to learn about. Yeah. Yeah.
Or just say hi.
Or just say hi.
And we also have a new Patreon page.
Yay!
If you want to buy us a drink.
Buy us a drink.
So that is
patreon.com/crimeandtimeotr.
And we're going to be offering some perks for our patrons.
Absolutely. I'm excited. See you there.
Thank you for listening.